Coming up on Liberalism in Question.
So you need an open society where people can think freely, talk freely, publish freely, and importantly, invest freely and then derive the benefits from their investments. There's a reason why almost all innovation in the world today comes from free countries.
Enjoy the show and be sure to follow and subscribe.
I'm Rob Forsyth and this is Liberalism in Question. In the late 18th century, Thomas Malthus, an English clergyman, wrote a book which makes what looks to be the obvious point, that population grows, but resources stay fairly finite or don't grow as much, and that's going to be a problem. And then in the 60s, the Club of Rome made the same point, early in his Population Bomb. And it seems kind of obvious, doesn't it, that we can't keep growing forever because the resources are limited. Well, the man sitting opposite me here is going to tell you that's not true. Martin Turpey is from Senior Fellow at the Cato Institute in Washington, D.C., and co-author of the Simon Abundance Index, and he's the author of a book called Superabundance, The Story of Population Growth, Innovation and Human Flourishing in an Infinitely Bountiful Planet. Welcome.
Thank you very much for having me.
Now, what made you begin to investigate whether or not what seems obvious, that resources can't keep up with population growth, may not be true?
Well, over the last 20 years, I think that the debate has been getting increasingly hysterical about the impact of humans on the world. Climate change is obviously part of it, but another very important aspect of this climate of doom and gloom was resources. Are we going to run out of resources given that the population of the world has reached 8 billion people? And so what I decided to do in about 2017 was to revisit the famous wager between Paul Ehrlich and Julian Simon, and I wanted to know if the wager still held.
And what was that wager?
Well, in 1980, Julian Simon, who was an economist in the United States at the University of Maryland, challenged Paul Ehrlich from Stanford University to a bet. Paul Ehrlich selected 5 metals, and they bet $1,000 on whether those metals would become more or less expensive. Ehrlich was arguing, yes, they would become more expensive. Simon was arguing they would become less expensive.
More expensive because there were less of them?
Oh, because there were more people.
More people.
So during the 1980s, the wager would last for 10 years, between 1980 and 1990. And in the 1980s, the world added something like 660 million people during that decade. And yet those resources became 37% cheaper.
Wow.
So what I wanted to do was to see if the relationship still held. It did.
Ehrlich lost the bet.
Ehrlich lost the bet.
And paid the money.
Paid $567 to Simon, yes.
Now that's amazing. Okay, keep going. Why was that so? What?
Well, the primary problem really is that Paul Ehrlich and people like him, usually biologists or people who come from environmental sciences,
yeah.
Attenborough is another one, Jane Goodall. They tend to see human beings simply as consumers. And yes, we consume a lot of stuff, but we are also creators, right? We not only consume resources, but we can expand our base of resources. So even Malthus himself, the great man himself, during his period of life, population of England increased massively. But the price of wheat and consequently bread has actually decreased relative to wages because Malthus was just looking at human beings as consumers. He completely missed the English agricultural revolution, which because of technological change and efficiency gains and so forth, has actually been able to produce much more food than was expected.
So you decided to research this again?
Correct. And then
How'd you go about that?
Well, partly, I changed my methodology after I got in touch, or after Gail Pooley, my co-author on the book, got in touch. And he said to me, you know, you are looking only at prices of commodities adjusted for inflation. But there is a better way of doing it, a more commonsensical way of doing it, and that is to look at time prices. And so together, we looked at resources from the perspective of a time price.
What's a time price?
Time price, money prices, be they nominal or real, are in dollars and cents, whereas time prices are in minutes and hours of work. The question you're asking is, how long does a person have to work in order to buy a pound of beef in 1980? And then how long does a person have to work to buy a pound of beef in 2023? So if in 1980 it took you an hour, but now it took you only, now it takes you only 30 minutes, that means that you're twice as well off. And so once we looked at commodities from perspective of time price, we discovered that everything is getting less expensive. People have to work less and less in order to be able to afford food, fuel, minerals, metals, and so forth. Now, of course, you cannot eat a pound of copper, but copper and zinc and iron, etc., are the inputs that go into the production process. So the cheaper that they are, the cheaper outputs.
Now, this is, I take it, long term, because just at the moment here in Australia, we're facing a cost of living.
Oh, yes.
And feeling the opposite.
Correct. So we have to discount for the last 2 or 3 years when, because of irresponsible policies of our governments, they have caused inflation. And so the purchasing power of the currency is, and our salaries are actually decreasing. That is absolutely true. But over a period of long time, the picture is very different. Globally, we look at the time prices of commodities going back to 1980 and then to 1960, and what we find is a general relationship whereby things are getting cheaper. And then what we do, because we have the data to do it, we go back to 1850 to look at American time prices. We have good data in the United States going to the late 18th century. So we can see how long workers had to work in, say, 1850 to buy a chicken or a pound of oranges, and then compare it to today.
Can you give me some examples of what you found?
I can give you the examples if you give me my book and give you an example.
So becoming, maybe it's becoming rather obviously self-promotion, I can try to say.
I'm afraid so. Let's say, well, so in the United States, between 1850 and 2018, a blue-collar worker, let's say somebody making a car, a blue-collar worker, a pound of rice over those 168 years decreased in time price by 99.1%, which means that for the same amount of work, which would have bought 1 pound of rice for somebody in 1850, he or she now can get 111 pounds today. When it comes to pork, 98.7% decrease in time price, which means that the same amount of time that bought a person 1 pound of pork in 1850 gets them 75 pounds of pork today.
And you found that right across the board?
We found that right across the board. And we also did a similar exercise for the world. So I can tell you how Australia ranks, if you allow me. So between 1980 and 2018, 50 basic commodities fell in time price in Australia by 73.8%, which means that over those 38 years only, 38 years, not a very long period of time, for the same amount of time that you would have gotten one unit in that 50 commodity basket, you can now get almost four units in that commodity.
Now, you're talking about natural resources at the moment, so things you grow. What about things like light?
Yes.
Things like that.
So what we look at are things that can be dug from the ground.
Yes.
Minerals, metals.
Yes.
Or things that can be grown. Wheat, cows, well, they're not really grown, but you know what
they grow.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, chickens and stuff like that. In the book, we also look at the price of light.
Explain that to me. That's rather intriguing. The price of light.
Well, what we actually quote from is the famous study by William Nordhaus, the Nobel Prize winning economist. And what he did, for example, he found that 1 hour of reading light back in the early 1800s would have cost you 8 hours of work. By the early 1990s, it was like 0.00001 second of work. So there was a tremendous amount of progress.
So the cost of light has been massively reduced.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, just think about it. Our ancestors would have to spend a lot of time gathering wood in order to create fire, in order to be able to read by that fire, if they were literate, which most of them weren't. Whereas today, because
then came candles, I imagine.
Yes, they can candles. Candles were still very expensive. I mean, you had to slaughter a whale, scoop out the spermaceti from its head, form it into candles. So that wasn't good for whales.
Then came electric light bulbs.
Then came kerosene. Then came electricity and so forth. But things get even weirder in the past when people were making light from sesame seeds and things like that, which was incredibly.
I didn't even know about that.
Yeah.
And today, of course, with LEDs and so forth, there's been another lift up.
Yes. I would have to search for it in the book.
But
I think we have done those calculations. So we look at light. We look at prices of vehicles. We look at time prices of electronics, which have just dropped.
Has anything else gone the other way?
Well, there are certain periods in time, certain episodes or periods when individual items become more expensive. So, for example, between 1980 and last year, we have seen an increase in time price of the prices of natural gas and oil. Because of the war in Ukraine and massive disruptions, when massive disruptions occur.
So what you're saying is that rather than the idea that population growth means less resources, in a very strange way, population growth with innovation means more resources.
Well, that's the fundamental part.
How can that be?
Well, because ultimately, growth of resources depends on having new ideas. So in the old days, we would fertilize our fields with manure or compost, things like that. But we have developed artificial or synthetic fertilizer, which is much more efficient and cheaper and easier to use. We had plants which were quite unproductive in the past. And through genetic engineering, for example, we were able to create plants which deliver much more food per acre of land. Scientists are working on types of crops that are not only more productive, but need less fertilizer, less pesticide, and less water. If we have water shortages, we can desalinate. So there are many different ways in which you can increase productivity and reduce resource use. For example, another example which I really like to use because everybody can understand it. Even 10 years ago, if you went to a hotel, you would find a thick blue copper cable running out of the wall that you had to plug into your laptop
An Ethernet cable.
Yes. So that you could plug into the internet. All those cables are now gone and replaced by Wi-Fi. So that's that process we call dematerialization.
Dematerialization.
Yes, we are not actually using any materials to connect to Wi-Fi. It's all done in the air, right? And so we are saving a lot of copper by not doing that. So that's another way, another efficiency gain.
Most people don't believe this. They have a belief that human beings are using up too much. This has been a natural view from, I'm sure, before Malthus. Why is your message so hard for people to believe?
Well, part of the reason I already described, that people sort of look at humans like they do look at other animals.
As a consumer, not an innovator.
Yes. I mean, in the natural world, if you have good rain and a lot of grass, the rabbits, will overpopulate.
That's a good Australian example, yes.
Oh, yeah. I didn't know that. And
we have rabbits galore here.
And then there's a population collapse, right? But humans are not like that. We have intelligence. We have long-term planning.
We are the most cooperative of all animals, social animals, and therefore produce a massive amount of learning that not everyone has to know the same thing. We share knowledge. That's the great, I think, reason why humans have been so effective.
Well, animals don't innovate. They sometimes use tools. They sometimes trade, but they don't innovate. We do. And that's the key difference. So that's part of the difference. And the other part of the difference, the other reason is that people keep on thinking in terms of finite atoms, that there is a finite number of atoms on Earth.
That's true, isn't it?
Well, for now. You know, eventually we will be able to import atoms from space. Already we are sending rockets to asteroids that may be rich in minerals, etc. So then there's actually a short step of bringing those materials back. But so people think in terms of finite atoms. They don't think in terms of infinite knowledge. And the crazy thing about knowledge is that the more knowledge you consume, the more you end up with.
Yes. It's what you, to quote, there's a great film in Australia called The Castle, where the father asks, what is this? Cook a cake. And she says, it's a sponge cake. But it's how you make it. What you're saying is the amount of literal stuff may be relatively finite. It's what you do with it that matters.
What you do with it
changes.
Matters, yeah. Now, and we can combine it and recombine it in many different ways.
Has this always been the case with human history? It seems to me that this has not always been the case, has it? There have been times of flat, long, long periods of relative no change in price.
Yes, the so-called Malthusian trap. So Malthus was actually a pretty good historian. He identified in history a pattern,
yes,
whereby you had spurts of population growth, but that would lead to overpopulation and then to starvation. Although how much of that was really overpopulation, how much of that was that people didn't know how to handle climatic changes? You know, the world, for example, became much cooler between 1300 and 1700, and people simply didn't have the technology to be able to address that. But fundamentally, there were as many people in the world at the time of Christ as there were 1500 years later. So you know, population was kept stable.
What happened?
And then in 1800, basically, we grow from 1 billion to 8 billion, and yet we have never been. Well, what changed was that first of all, there were massive improvements in agricultural techniques.
So it's the innovation. Absolutely,
yes.
The innovation produced the population growth.
Yes, it was. Those two are heavily connected, yes.
Now, this is your theory, this is your claim of superabundance, that we don't have to think about limits to growth, to quote the phrase thing. What about the climate? What about the externalities, as they put it? What about our growth is producing pollution and using up our planet? Isn't that a limit on growth to growth?
Well, I'm not a climate scientist, but what worries me about this particular debate is that we keep on talking about negative externalities, some of which are real, some of which are overblown. We don't spend enough time discussing how vital fossil fuels are to making our lives comfortable or even tolerable. Everything around us is created with some input of fossil fuels, and it actually contributes toward creating a society or a civilization where you can wake up in the morning in Canadian winter and fly down to Caribbean summer, and it's a difference of, you know, 100 degrees, and yet you are able to flourish in both places within a scope of 24 hours because we have built the infrastructure that allows human beings to flourish.
So you think we can continue to innovate in the face, let's grant climate change for the sake of the argument, in the face of a variable climate, we can innovate our way to coping?
I think that that is our best hope to get at the problem of global warming and climate change through technological change. I want to make it clear that we wouldn't have to be here, by and large, had it not been for the fact that in the 1970s we stopped building nuclear power stations. We already have the technology that could allow us to produce as much cheap energy as we want to for humanity. It's called nuclear fission, and hopefully at some point nuclear fusion. It was a choice that we have made to abandon nuclear, and therefore we are in a place where we didn't have to be.
This is my point. As I understand it, what are the social conditions that require superabundance to work? What kind of societies do you have to have for this to work? And the next question is, how can people stuff it up? Or come to the first one. What do you need for superabundance? Are there conditions?
Yes, you do need a good chunk of human freedom, both political and economic. We know that because China, which has always been the most populous country in the world until very recently, being overtaken by India, China had all the people, but it didn't have the freedom that would allow them to flourish. It was only after economic reforms, after 1978, that China suddenly was able to produce the amount of wealth that it did. So you need an open society where people can think freely, talk freely, publish freely, and importantly, invest freely and then derive the benefits from their investments. There's a reason why almost all innovation in the world today comes from free countries.
So a liberal society is a prosperous, will create a prosperous, innovative society.
Your findings?
Yes, provided that, for example, extreme environmentalists or bureaucracies don't prevent us from creating wealth.
What are the enemies of innovation then? What can go wrong?
There are a lot of enemies of innovation. There are people who don't believe that economic growth and prosperity is a good thing. The proponents of the degrowth theory, for example. Then you have bureaucracies, which may not necessarily want to kill off growth, but they will do so simply through the natural expansion of their powers and how bureaucracies function. Wokeism is a great enemy of innovation and of progress because it has a chilling effect on freedom of speech. And freedom of thought. You cannot really have proper freedom of thought if you haven't been exposed to different ideas, some of which may have been banned because they are not in accordance with the latest reiteration of wokeism. And of course, freedom of the market is incredibly important because it should be the market that decides which technologies and which products take off rather than governments picking winners and losers in the marketplace.
We've been talking about things, the price of things, be they turnips or light. What about services?
So,
because that's very much in which developed societies like ours are growing in services, which are different sort of beast, aren't they, to things?
Precisely. Most people assume that productivity gains in services must be very difficult because of the Baumol effect. Basically, it's quite difficult to explain. But essentially, what it means is that even unproductive services have to be paid at a very high level in order for them to exist. So
yes.
Let me give you an example: a massage in ancient Rome is essentially the same as a massage today, except that the masseur today in the West makes, you know, $100 an hour, maybe $150 an hour, whereas in ancient Rome, he maybe worked for one...
Probably a slave.
Yeah, probably a slave. But they are so well paid, because if they weren't so well paid, nobody would do the massage. They would be maybe computer coding or whatever. So that's the Baumol effect. In other words, even in those services where there are no productivity gains, people still get paid a lot of money. But is that true? I think that we need to look at it. We need to do some more scholarly work. In this book, we looked at one service, and that was the provision of cosmetic surgery. The reason why we wanted to do that is because cosmetic surgery involves many of similar processes that happen in healthcare, which in the United States is rising stratospherically in cost.
Right, yes.
You know, you still need your nurses, you still need your anesthesiologists, you still need medical doctors, you need hospitals. And what we found was that in cosmetic surgery, prices are dropping like a rock. It's growing at a superabundant rate. And we suspect it's because people actually shop for the best price, they negotiate price, they pay out of their own pocket. And because there is no third-party payer, the prices are actually kept at a competitive level.
But you did say other prices are going up in society.
So in healthcare in the United States, and in education, for example, the prices are rising at a faster rate than wages. What we were trying
is that a long-term trend or just...
Yes, it's a long-term trend.
If not...
What we are trying to show through this particular exercise of cosmetic surgery is to show that if the American healthcare system was run along the similar principles that cosmetic surgery is run and paid for, that we might see the prices actually go down.
Right. So you think there may be ways in which the superabundance principle may apply to services, even though services are not really things?
Yes, because we assume competition. The assumption is that part of the reason why the price of beef is falling relative to wages is because you have a lot of competition between French farmers and American and Australian and New Zealand and so on.
Actually, not as much. There's a lot of protectionism when it comes to French farmers.
Well, there is.
And that I suppose is the challenge of your view. Innovation requires freedom. It requires challenge. It requires change. And with change, it can be short-term, very disturbing for people.
Yes.
And therefore, there is the phrase creative destruction. And that must be the price needed, on what you're saying, that we need to deal with a world which has to cope with the challenges of change in order to become more prosperous.
Yes, it is unavoidable. Now, there are societies which choose to be technologically stagnant. European Union, for example, produces very little innovation compared to the United States because they have embraced a precautionary principle. They are satisfied, at least on the surface, with lower incomes in order to gratify or appease the god of precautionary principle. But if your goal is higher standards of living and higher income, then creative destruction is unavoidable. And that has always been so. Imagine if people 100 years ago said that the arrival of the motor car is going to displace all the drivers of,
the handsome cab, yes.
And things like that. Then of course, we wouldn't have a motor car. We would still be riding horses and whatever. Imagine if people refused to embrace the Bronze Age and stuck with stone tools simply because you didn't want to put all those stone tool makers out of business.
Yes, understand.
Societies make choices.
Am I also right in thinking that where there's greater prosperity, there's higher in actual taxes, so there's more ways that governments can actually provide services for their people as well. In other words, it's not simply about individual prosperity, but the society itself can rise in its services.
Yes, of course. Although my fear is that we are getting to a point where there is so much social redistribution that people are disincentivized from
working. Understand that.
And I would prefer that people continue to work in order to create those new ideas, but also because I think that work gives people a sense of meaning, which a lot of people in the West lack today, and also a structure to one's day. And a sense of self-worth.
Now, this is so counterintuitive, and yet you've got strong evidence about superabundance. Has anyone refuted you?
There's never been any academic pushback in terms of the methodology that we have employed. And before we wrote the book, we obviously ran it by serious scholars in the United States and elsewhere.
Martin Tooby, that's fascinating. Thank you so much for joining us on Liberalism in Question.
Thank you very much for having me.
It looks like liberalism can, in the right circumstances, lead to greater...